Introduction and the Nature of History. The first talk in a series titled History of Christian Thought was presented by David Crabtree on September 28, 1987, for McKinsey Study Center's School of Exegesis. McKinsey Study Center is now an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and many of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Crabtree's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
This is a class, the History of Christian Thought. If you'll look at your syllabus, this is what we'll talk about this quarter. Tonight I'm just going to give an introduction. Mainly what I'm going to talk about is the nature of history. And if you want to discuss that, I would be glad to. That would be. Next week, I'm going to give an overview of the history of Rome. I'll probably go back 300 or 400 years before Christ, maybe a little bit earlier. And I want to go all the way up to the Middle Ages in an hour. So it's kind of a rapid survey. But there are a few things that I want to point out that I think are very significant in the development of Christianity. And you really can't divorce the development of Christianity from what was happening politically in the world. I mean, that you can see the same thing going on in our culture right now. The development of Christian thought in American culture right now is greatly affected by the political developments within the country. I want to talk about Jewish Christianity. As you will learn, that topic to me is extremely interesting. Christianity started out as a Jewish religion, but it took almost no time for that to be lost on the church. In a very short time, the church forgot that it was that Christianity had Jewish roots and ignored its Jewish roots. And I think that's very significant, and I'll explain why. I will talk about the Anti-Nicene Fathers. Those are the church fathers who wrote and preached before the Council of Nicaea. I'll talk about Gnosticism, which is a significant development that is... It took on a wide variety of forms, but I'm going to reduce it down to one kind of prototype and talk about that. I'm going to talk about interpretation of the Bible as it was practiced by the early church fathers. And I think that you will see that some of the developments in their method of interpretation has affected interpretation down to this day. The Trinitarian controversy, sequel to that, the Christological controversy. And I will try to explain those as best I can. I want to talk about developments within the popular understanding of Christianity, things that grew up from kind of a grassroots movement. And a lot of those things you can still see remnants of, particularly in the Catholic Church. And that, well, I'll talk about that later today, but I'll explain why that's particularly interesting to me later. Jerome will be the topic, and the reason that he is interesting is because he spearheaded a number of these movements in popular Christian piety as well as monasticism. And so he's an interesting person. He's kind of typical for the time period. Monasticism, the development of monasticism. I'll tell you the books that I have found most interesting. There is a series of books called, I think it's called The Pelican History of Christianity. It's put out by Pelican Books. Pelican History of the Church, I'm sorry. Pelican History of the Church. I believe there are six volumes. There are six volumes. Each volume is written by a different author in that particular series. As a result, the books, some of the books are very, very good. Some of them are very, very dull. The first one is The History of the Early Church by Henry Chadwick, I believe. There's another one by Owen Chadwick. One of the Chadwick authors wrote the first one. I think it's Henry Chadwick wrote the first one. That one, I think, is quite good. And it covers the time from the time of the apostles until after Augustine. I think it approaches the Middle Ages. And of the six, I think that's the best one. There's another good one in the series is on the Reformation, and I think that one is by Owen Chadwick. And I think that's the second best of the six. I don't recommend the one on the Middle Ages unless you're I thought that was quite dry.
Just a lot of facts and
figures. He talks about how much money the church had and how they organized their monasteries. So that's one series of books. Another series of books that I found very helpful is a series by Justo Gonzalez. And it is called, I think it's called A History of Christian Thought. It's three volumes. And I think it is very good throughout. It's a little bit too abbreviated in some sections. I wish he would have included more detail in certain sections. But in general, I think it's quite good. I think it's The History of Christian Thought. That's what I have written down here for one book. And I think that's that series. The most helpful thing, when you talk about the development of Christian thought as opposed to church history, the most helpful series is a series by Yaroslav Pelikan. And it's called The Christian Tradition. The series is called The Christian Tradition. And there are, I think that there are supposed to be seven volumes in the series, but only four or five are completed. But he is, I think now he's the head of some department at Yale. He used to teach at the University of Chicago, and he is very erudite. He really knows his materials. And he takes for granted that you know the events of the history of the church. He takes for granted your knowledge of that material. So if you were to just go and look at volume one, like I started out doing, it makes very little sense. You have to read something else or have some introduction to the history of the Christian church before you can read him. And even after you've read that, he's difficult to read in spots, but he's very, very perceptive. The series is called The Christian Tradition. Volume 1 is especially good, and it's called The Emergence of the Catholic Church, I think it's called. The Emergence of the Catholic Church. In what way? In all ways. As I understand it, he knows six or seven languages very, very well. As you can tell from his name, he's Slavic. He reads Russian and I don't know who else, Bulgarian, something else. He knows Latin and Greek extremely well. And he's read all of the works of the fathers in Latin and Greek in the original language. There's an interesting story about him. He graduated from the University of Chicago. And in the rules for writing a doctoral dissertation for the University of Chicago, you have an option of writing it in Latin. And when he wrote his doctoral dissertation, he opted to write it in Latin at a time when no one had written it in Latin for years and years and years. I don't know if anybody could read it. I think he was just bluffing them. But he wrote his doctoral dissertation in Latin. But you can tell from reading him that he has very good control of the primary sources in a day and age where that's rare. So if you're interested in pursuing that particular appraisal of the development of Christian thought, he's excellent. All my good stuff is from him. And those are the books that I would, those are the three series that I would recommend. There are lots of them available, but you'll see. I have my own slant on this stuff, so you'll see. These are the books that most match my idiosyncrasy. Okay. In the course, we are going to try to cover the development of Christian thought from the time of the apostles. We are going to look at the apostles' way of thinking, but we'll start after they died. We'll pick up with the apostolic fathers, which is, there's a slight time gap there. And then go right through to the present. And hopefully you will get an idea of the genealogy, the thinking of modern Christian culture, modern American Christian culture. Okay, first of all, just a philosophy of history. Why study history? There is a quote that I have seen attributed to two different people, and learning from Biden's lesson, I need to make sure that I attribute it. The last person I heard it attributed to was Hegel. But the quote goes something like this: the only thing that we can learn from history is that we don't learn from history. And unfortunately, that's extremely true, that we do not learn from history. Someone else said the only thing... history is actually very, very important to us. And it bothers me that history is so neglected in our education today. If you take a science like chemistry, you have the opportunity to observe chemicals reacting and to make hypotheses as to what is taking place there. And then you get out your test tube and you put those two chemicals in the test tube and see what happens under controlled conditions. And so you can test out your hypothesis. And that's a wonderful approach to take towards learning about the natural world. But you can't do that with human beings. You can't stuff human beings into a test tube and see what happens. It doesn't work. There's no experiment that you can run that actually works without altering the result. Once you put human beings under study, it already affects the result. We can, however, learn from experience. We have a whole backlog of experience of human beings in action, and that's history. In particular, we have a lot of experience with societies of human beings in action. And we can observe what happened in those societies. And we can make hypotheses. And then we can look at the various time periods and see if the hypotheses work out. It's a matter of sorting through the evidence to determine as best you can what in fact happened. And for most of our purposes, that is possible. We can gain enough reliable information, I think, to make some important discoveries, just given the information that we do have. Well, several sources, a number of sources that all agree, both the written record and the archaeological record, for instance. So history is really a way of studying the nature of man. And in particular, the nature of man in society. Now, what is the nature of history? How is it? Well, let me, one other comment. There is an essay by C.S. Lewis called, it's on old books or something. It's in his collection of essays called God and the Doc. I think it's called On Old Books. And in that essay, he says, would it be better to read good books in our contemporary setting? Or would it be better to read good books from ages in the past? And he concludes that it would be better to read books from ages in the past. And his reasoning is that if we read books written by our contemporaries, they are looking at reality using the same assumptions that we have towards life. But if we read books written at another time, we will be reading someone's perspective who does not share our assumptions, their perspective on the same reality. And therefore, it's easier to build a more accurate model, a more accurate understanding of this reality. And I think the same thing could be true of history. People in history in another day and age were coping with the same reality, but they were coming at it from a different angle. And by studying how they viewed reality, we can get a more comprehensive view of it. So there's much to be gained from a study of history. I would contend that our neglect of a study of the history is one symptom of the fact that we live in a dark age. I would say that right now we live in a dark age. And you would say, well, we went to the moon, didn't we? Isn't that what you'd say?
We went to the moon, didn't
we? Yeah, that's right. But I would still say we live in a dark age. We have developed skills along technological lines, but we are not educated. In the past, there were times when people were educated. I mean, they stressed education. And to them, education meant coming to an understanding of what life is, why we're here, and what we should be doing. And a great deal of mental energy was devoted to those questions. In our day and age, a great deal of mental energy goes towards avoiding those ways of keeping those questions from coming to the forefront of our minds. So it's true that we are technologically advanced, but we are not educated. We don't know what life is about as a culture. And we aren't interested. Our culture says there is no truth. So it makes sense that our culture doesn't pursue learning, understanding, pursuit of the truth. So I would say that we live in a dark age, and our neglect of history is just a symptom of that. History is a vast storehouse of information that we could use to develop our understanding of reality, and we don't care about it. As we go through in this class, charting the development of Christian thought, there won't be enough time to talk about everything in detail, obviously. There won't even be enough time to give a really good summary. But there are two things that I would like to accomplish. And if I do that, I'll be very satisfied. One is to give you a general idea of the development that history went through. Why one thing followed another. Another thing that I hope to point out is where the ideas that we see present in our modern Christian tradition, where they came from. And a lot of them, I think you'll be able to see their roots. It's pretty obvious where they come from. And I think you'll be surprised at where they came from. Things that you take for granted. Oh yes, that is a Christian idea. That is biblically grounded. It's clear to me, and I hope to make it clear to you, I hope that it becomes clear to you, that some of those came from an extra-biblical source. And they aren't Christian at all. What? No. I'll save it. So I hope that that's another thing that I will accomplish, is to give you some idea of where a lot of things that are present in our modern Christian culture came from. And another thing that I would like to accomplish is to give you an appreciation for history in general. It is very interesting. History is fascinating. Okay, the nature of history. And this is where we'll talk about the philosophy of history, and I would very much welcome any dialogue on this. You must realize that it is impossible to record everything that happens in a given event. It is impossible. For instance, right at this moment, describe everything that happened. My hands hit, the temperature was whatever it is, Linda's heart was beating, or was it happening between beats? The air currents were such and such, the light was on, the color of the wall was what it is, etc., etc. I mean, no book would be able to contain what happened in that instant, let alone an event that takes place over several days. So history is selective. The historian has to look at the event and say to himself, out of everything that happened in that event, what is significant? What is worthy of recording? What is it out of that event that I want to convey to my readers? In order to do that, the historian has to have some set of values. He has to have some basis on which to decide what aspects of that event are significant and which ones are not significant. As a result, history is extremely value-laden. Any historical account is extremely value-laden. Everything that's in that account is there because the historian decided, out of everything that he knew about that event, he decided which things were significant enough to record. And he decided that on the basis of his set of values. Pretty good kind. What you're getting is you're getting the mindset of a person who lived in that time period. That's why I came to these conclusions when I was thinking about biblical narratives, interpretation of biblical narratives. That's what you do in biblical narratives. Most of the Bible is biblical narrative. And I used to think, well, what can you learn from that? All you learn is what happened. But history is not a record of what happened. History is a record of what the author thought was significant out of the things that happened. As a result, by reading his historical narrative, you can extrapolate what are the values of the author. In the case of the Bible, those are the values of God. So history is a source, or historical narrative is a means to getting back the value system of the author. That becomes very obvious when you're trying to put together your own historical account. When I was putting together the syllabus for this class, my values are right there. I had to decide what's worth including and what's not worth including. And it's all on the basis of my values. The reason is because I have not read a lot of the primary sources. That would take a lot of time, and I'm not enough interested in this, in the history of Christian thought, to devote all my time to it. So most of my information is from secondary sources like these, the books that I talked about at the very beginning of the class. So for the most part, I'm going to take their word for it, what happened. And so I will, and you need to realize that that's my starting point, is that these people have a basically accurate account of the historical events.
By primary source, do you mean in the original languages, or do you mean would a primary source also be just an interpretation into English of?
Yeah, I don't necessarily mean in the original languages. However, obviously that would be preferable. But by primary source, I mean an account written by someone who was there, or evidence that is firsthand in some way. But I used as my starting point the accounts of historians that live in our day and age who have looked at the primary sources and have drawn their own conclusions as to what happened. Explain your thinking a little bit more. I'm not sure where you're going.
It's
important to understand the Bible times for what?
Just to understand the Bible.
Yes.
I don't even know if that was connected to something you said, but...
Well, definitely.
Will we be doing
in other classes? To a certain degree. But not systematically, I don't think. I don't think in your curriculum that there will be... We did in the old curriculum, but I don't think in this curriculum there's anything devoted to that. But I'm convinced that an understanding of the history of the times of the Old Testament is crucial to understanding the Old Testament. But our major source for that is the Bible itself. The only thing we have to go on besides that is archaeological evidence as well as written sources from neighboring cultures. But Christianity is a historical religion. Christianity is very, very deeply rooted in human history. And God did that on purpose. And as a result, it's important for us to understand that history. To understand Christianity. Well, Judaism, I'm not sure.
I mean, particularly.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I could give you an answer, but it would be... I don't know if it would be true. That hasn't stopped me before, but I'm trying to tighten up my...
Is that what this means in the future?
Yeah, in the future. But I know of no other religion where God became man. And like Abraham, God chose a man and blessed him and developed in him a heart of faith. And out of him came a nation. And that nation was the chosen people of God. And out of that chosen people of God came a man who was God, who died. All of those things are intimately connected with history. Any other religion that I'm aware of, there are some historical events that are cited in that religion. But if you remove the historicity of those events, it wouldn't affect the teachings of that religion. The religion could still stand on its own. Christianity could not stand on its own if it was removed from history. Well, I don't know enough, but to the extent that I'm aware of it, it wouldn't matter if the events of Muhammad's life had occurred or not. You could still have a self-contained religion called Islam. Now, I may be wrong, but to the extent I know of it, I understand it, that would be possible. If Christ had never existed, you could not have Christianity. Since history is valuated, it's dependent on the perspective of the author, you get various accounts of the same event. They can all be factual and yet portray a very different occurrence. For instance, let's assume that the accounts in the newspaper of some event are true, factual. I'm asking you to assume a lot. But let's assume that we have two different newspaper accounts of the same event, and they are factual. Still, they can portray a very different event. They can leave a very different impression on you as to what happened. My wife and I were in an automobile accident, and we were eyewitnesses. We read the account in the newspaper, and it was reasonably factual. But it sounded like a very different thing occurred than actually occurred. Very different. It was like a different accident, one that we weren't at. So accounts of history can be factual, nevertheless very different. It's because of different values as to what is important. Values, and the other thing is information sources. Information sources can affect it, values affect it, and also purpose can affect it. What is the purpose of the historian? For instance, if the historian is observing a battle and he wants to talk about strategies, then he'll give one account of history. But if he wants to talk about the effect of war on the spirit of man, he would have a different... And both of them can be factual, but they'll be very different. Given that there are those variables, as we try to understand history, what is our goal? I would say that our goal is to try to reconstruct God's perspective on the event that occurred. Let me give you an example from the Bible. There was a king who was a couple kings after David by the name of Omri. And as I understand it, based on the existing information, historical information that is extra-biblical, Omri is the most prominent king of Israel. Of all the kings of Israel, he was Judah and Israel. He was the most prominent. And yet, in the Old Testament, he reads about 6 verses. Given our historical information, David barely existed. Extra-biblical information. David barely existed. From the perspective of the biblical writers, David was the most significant of all the kings of Israel. So there can be a very big difference between the significance of an event or aspects of an event from God's perspective and that same event looked at through the eyes of a contemporary historian.
So the question was, what is our goal in understanding history?
Mm-hmm.
And our goal is to try from God's perspective.
Try it as best we can to reconstruct God's perspective on that event. In other words, we want to approach history with values that match God's values. That's very difficult to do in practice. It would be fascinating to read God's account of the history of America or something. Because my guess is that... my guess is that from God's perspective, some nobody in eastern Oregon, Sabin Bend, who has compassion on a grieving widow may very well be more significant than Governor Goldschmidt, the famous Governor Goldschmidt. But from the human perspective, there's no comparison. Governor Goldschmidt has to be more significant. But from God's perspective, it could very well be that nobody in eastern Oregon is more significant. The problem is it's very difficult to evaluate the effect that person in eastern Oregon had. It's much easier to see the effect. As it turns out, that the stuff of history is what historians have left behind. And they recorded things about kings and popes and religious leaders. As a result, that's what we will be looking at. It's unfortunate that history has not preserved the accounts of those people who have done good deeds in anonymity. As Robbie mentioned, a lot of our information is pre-digested material. There are people in the past who have looked at the events of history and they have decided what is worth keeping and what is not worth keeping. When it comes to the history of Christian thought, the church played a big role in that because it was in the monasteries that books were copied and recopied. As a result, there are some very interesting figures in the history of the church about whom we have almost no information. For instance, Sibelius. What we know about him is very intriguing to me, but we have very little because he was declared a heretic. Jovinian was another person that may very well have had some good ideas, but he was declared a heretic very early on, and we have very little information, etc. We don't have any of their writings. All we have are writings against them. People who say, you say blank and that's wrong, but we don't know what they said.
Because it was destroyed,
because they were declared heretics. So that's unfortunate, but that's the reality of the situation. So as a result, our view of history is somewhat shaped by the church, the historic church itself. Okay, it's important for you to understand how my mind works. There are some very good reasons why I should not be teaching this class. One of those is theology proper bores me. Certain aspects of it bore me. For instance, consubstantiation and transubstantiation are not interesting to me. Those ideas are not interesting to me. It doesn't hold my interest enough for me to even take it seriously enough to try to figure out what different people's views were on those topics. Now, there's a debate that comes up in that regard as to what effect it would have if a mouse were to eat bread consecrated for communion. It's during the age of Scholasticism. No, it would be 1300, 1400. To me, that isn't even interesting. That's not even worth pursuing. It's a non-question. There are a lot of those that arise. There's another one that arose earlier. If there is a bodily resurrection, what happens to the fingernails? That's not interesting to me. But there are a lot of issues that have been raised and kicked around that are not even interesting to me. They don't hold my interest enough to even look into them and take them seriously and try to figure out why they thought those things. So that's one problem. The other problem is I have a terrible time remembering names and dates and that sort of thing. And that is not good if you're a historian. The way we are taught history is made of names and dates, and that's all it consists of. But I have a terrible time remembering them. Oh, and another thing is, when I read books, I have a habit of, my mind is actively engaged, unless I'm asleep. My mind is very actively engaged, and I think along with what I read. But what happens is, I bounce off of what I read and start generating other thoughts. And as those thoughts get spit out, I say, oh, there was a good one, and that gets filed away. And the other ones, if they're bad, I just let them bounce out. But if they're good, I grab them and file them away. The problem is, I never know whether that was in the book that I was reading or that was generated by my thinking about what I was reading. I can have a thought that's generated because of reading something that that person never even dreamt of. It's not in the book anywhere. And later, I swear I got that from that book, and I'll go back and look for it, and look for it, and look for it. I'll read through the book a couple of times, and it's nowhere. And all I can guess is that is a problem, because I can't remember where some of those things came from. No, they generate good thoughts. Those books generate very good.
If you're active.
Yeah, that's unless you're sleeping. That's right. So those are some faults I have as a historian. The things that commend me for teaching this class, one is I was the only one who was brave enough to do it. Secondly, I am able to generalize. I like to generalize. And that's what this course is a series of generalizations. Hopefully it's on the basis of something. And thirdly, I like history. So I am interested in enough to pursue. That's all I have to say tonight. Next time we'll get started. I'm not. I am still trying to put that together. A long-term project that I would like to pursue is the construction of a theology of social change. I think I'll get around to responding to your question. What is it that happens when society changes? Is it a grassroots kind of thing that brings about social change? Or is it a great person, a great thinker, that brings about social change? Or is it sometimes one, sometimes the other? Or is it neither of those? How do societies change? What are all of the aspects to that?
And demonstration.
What?
Demonstration.
That's an important aspect of the whole process of change. Judicial rulings is another one. How does it occur? What is cause and what is effect? Well, I think there are two sources of information to develop a theology. One is scripture, and the other is experience. In other words, in this case, history.
Okay.
From God's perspective, as he looks down on all these people bouncing into each other doing weird things, how does society change? What is happening? What is the chain of events that occurs?
What is really responsible?
What is cause and what's effect in that process? And if that were clearer in my mind, I think I would be able to decide between the eight views. But that has not been clarified in my own mind. And that is something that, as we go through this course, I'd like to talk about.